KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
And you are tuned to 94.9 KUOW Seattle, KUOW.org. I'm Marcy Silman. In case you have not yet heard, Steve Scheer is taking a very well-deserved sabbatical. I'm going to be holding down the fort until October, 5 months from now. So just so you know, he'll be back. Do not fear. This is May 1st. Coming up on the show this hour, Mike Daisy, Deborah Madison, the queen of vegetarian cooking, vegetable cooking, I should say. We're also going to have news from Canada, our usual triple C panel, Todd Bishop in to talk tech, and Robert Horton talking about cinema. But we want to talk about May Day first, and just a heads up, drivers and transit riders in the Seattle area are going to be bracing for detours and traffic tie-ups as they head around town later today. The first May Day rally will kick off at Westlake Park in downtown Seattle in about an hour, 10 o'clock this morning. Immigrants' rights supporters are going to gather at 1 p.m. at St. Mary's Church in Judkins Park in the central area of Seattle. That rally is expected to draw about 3,000 people. They're going to march from Judkins Park to the federal building downtown. That march will happen about 3 o'clock. And later this evening, around 6 o'clock, you can expect a gathering at the corner of Pike and Broadway on Capitol Hill. And I haven't yet seen any estimate as to the size of that, but just beware. The international Occupy movement has called for global disruption today. That could start as early as 10 here. We really don't know. Around the world, May Day is an occasion to celebrate working men and women, International Workers' Day. Despite the number of events that I just listed off planned for the Seattle area, nothing is specifically focused on labor, and that got us thinking about labor, workers, why Labor Day in the United States is in September instead of May. So we invited an expert here who can explain May Day's origins and the evolution in this country. George Lovell's the Harry Bridges Endowed Chair in Labor Studies at the University of Washington's Political Science Department. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having me on the show.
Well, we're not going to go back to the very origins of May Day, which is a pagan celebration with ribbons and ash poles. But as according to my reading, sort of modern May Day celebrations started in the 19th century. Is that right?
Yes, it was started in the late 19th century. It was chosen during the Second International, which was an international socialist organization in 1889, I think. And it was picked. I think that May 1st is a good day for a celebration going a long way back. But it was picked in particular to is the date of the Haymarket Affair, which was a labor protest in Chicago in 1886, thanks, that resulted in a bomb going off, and there was some violence, and a lot of international attention was paid to it as labor unrest. So it was an important symbolic event that they wanted to recognize.
But the Haymarket was in the United States, not in Europe.
Right. It was in the United States, but it got a lot of international attention. And I think the aspiration was to create an international day that would be honored all over the world. And so the United States, that was a high-profile recent event. And so that was the event that was chosen to be honored.
Was the Haymarket rally specifically focused on labor rights?
Yes. It was a citywide strike that was done for the eight-hour day. That was organized by a central labor council there.
So a few years later, May 1st was selected as this International Workers' Day. Was that something that American labor movement people were also honoring?
Well, there was talk in the U.S. actually even before that of starting a labor holiday, and some states recognized labor holidays that were on different dates. And then there was more attention to it in an effort to get a national holiday in the U.S. associated with May Day or some other day. But what eventually happened is that it was established after the Pullman strike, which was another major issue of labor unrest in the U.S. that was in 1894. And it was a sort of compromise where President Cleveland agreed to recognize it as a holiday, but didn't want it to be on May 1st because that had radical and socialist associations. So it ended up being located in September in the U.S. as Labor Day.
How is America's Labor Day different from this May 1st occasion that's celebrated in almost every other first world country?
Right. Well, I think that part of what's happening and the reason why we're seeing a lot of protests in the U.S. and in Seattle today is that May 1st is sort of the alternative Labor Day, and especially for people that have international aspirations of building an international movement, it makes sense to do it on May 1st because, and this was on the news this morning, there's protests going on in other parts of the world today, so it's a way of expressing solidarity. Labor Day has sort of lost its association with labor in some respects. It's now a retail sale day where a lot of retail workers have to work overtime, and it's sort of the marking the end of summer and putting away the seersucker suit rather than really being recognizing as a day for labor.
We're talking about Labor Day with George Lovell, the Harry Bridges Endowed Chair in Labor Studies from the University of Washington. It seems like the last 6-7 years, the at least in the Seattle area, the major rallies around May Day are focused on immigration rights. What is the connection between labor history and immigration rights?
Well, I think there is a strong connection because the immigrants who are here as workers, and they're protesting in part for better treatment as workers in the way that they're treated there. I think the association now with immigration rights goes back to in 2006, where there was a coordinated boycott and effort to draw attention to the issue of immigrant rights when there was pending legislation in Congress at that time. And so since then, it's become a day of rallying for the immigrant community and immigrant activists in the United States. But I think it's also recognized there's a connection between that and labor. So there are labor organizations in the Seattle area that are joining the immigrant rights rally today in Seattle.
Most organizations or only some organizations joining in?
I'm not sure exactly, but it has been promoted on the State Labor Council's website and things like that as an event for people to go to and for labor to join. So I think that there's a lot of solidarity with the immigrant organizations and recognizing that it's important that those workers be treated well as well.
Before I introduced you, I sort of listed off, at 10 o'clock, event that's happening, which we're not really sure what exactly the focus of that event is. Uh-huh. The 6 p.m. event is being coordinated by the Occupy movement,
right,
which is not so centralized, as you know. When we have these various kinds of rallies with different organizers, does that serve to magnify focus on labor in this day, or do you think it sort of diffuses the message?
It's hard to say. I'm not exactly sure what the message is of the other two, or what their message is going to be for the other two marches. I think the success of it, of each of these individual events, is going to depend some on what people have to say at them and how people conduct themselves and what sorts of attention they're able to draw to issues and whether that's positive or negative attention. So I think it's hard to say in anticipation, and I don't know exactly who the organizers are of the other events.
It isn't really clear, at least from our perusal of the web. One thing I'm wondering is that here we sit in 2013. Internationally, I know that there have been rallies in every major city, pretty much in the Western world, at least. But here in the United States, organized labor is struggling. I guess that's a fair word for it.
Right.
And so, as you look ahead from the vantage point of knowing the history and working in the political science, are we going to see these as more a symbolic day celebrating the past, or are they a launching point for organizing efforts?
Well, I think it's hard to I try not to predict things in the future because I'm often wrong. But I think that, and it's hard to predict of exactly where this is going, but I do think that we're going to see more things like relatively, it's not really unconventional, but public protests and other kinds of events like that. And that's probably a healthy thing for a democracy and a society. There's a long tradition of doing that. And there are big problems now that are faced not just by organized labor, but by all members of the working class and a lot of unorganized workers. And so I think the labor movement has been struggling some, and it's a reflection of certain policies and things that make it difficult for workers to organize effectively here. And that, in turn, is a reflection of we've had a lot of dysfunction in our national political institutions and antiquated laws and those kinds of things that are making it very difficult for people to organize effectively and get their interests heard.
When we just going back to the idea of the focus on immigrants' rights and immigrants as a large labor pool in the United States, I know that there's a lot of when there aren't a lot of jobs and when a lot of the jobs are not very well paying, it can be an easy target to point to the newcomers as you're usurping what working wage jobs are left. And I'm wondering if there is a peace at the core between labor organizers and immigrants' rights organizers, or is that something that really folks have to work towards?
Well, I think it's historically for a long time been a complicated relationship, but I think that this is a stage where things are actually pretty constructive in terms of relationships between the two sets of organizations, because I think there is a realization of a certain amount of shared interest, and there's also a realization that because of features of the economy and the global economy, now work is moving around and workers are moving around in response to different kinds of conditions, and so it's not possible to just isolate things within the United States or to blame immigrants for problems that are happening in the United States. People are coming here because there are exploitative conditions in their own countries, and some of that is being fueled by the American economy that's demanding things like cheap garments made in factories in Bangladesh, and we see how that creates difficult conditions in those places as well.
So it's interesting to go back to 1886, the original, I suppose, the modern kickoff of this whole movement. As I have read, there were immigrants' rights advocates at that rally in Chicago.
That may have been part of it. I actually am not expert there, so I don't know that for sure. So I can't speak to that.
George, thank you so much for coming in today.
Thanks for having me.
George Lovell's the Harry Bridges Endowed Chair for Labor Studies in the Department of Political Science at the University of Washington in Seattle. This is Weekday.
Nine 17, author, actor, storyteller Mike Daisy joins us in a minute.
Support for KUOW comes from the Snoqualmie Tribe Fund, caring about community stewardship and culture, proud supporters of the Seattle Symphony. More about the Snoqualmie Tribe and its community investments, programs, and services is at SnoqualmieTribe.com.
49 degrees and sunny in Seattle, expecting sun all day and an afternoon high of 64. Tomorrow, Thursday, more sun with a high of 70. And then we're basically expecting sunny days with temperatures in the 70s all the way through at least Tuesday. I'm Bernard Ouellet. It's 9:17. Get to know your veggies in 20 minutes.
From 94.9 KUOW, I'm Marcy Silman. I want you to turn your minds back a couple years in Seattle to a wildly successful stage production that you might have seen at Seattle Repertory Theater. It's called The Agony and Ecstasy of Steve Jobs, created and performed by Mike Daisy. Saw the show, loved the show. It was recorded and broadcast, or at least portions of it, on the radio show This American Life. And 2 months after that, Ira Glass apologized for presenting a piece of theater as a piece of journalism. Make no mistake, Mike Daisy is a theater guy. His show, 21 Dog Years, doing time at Amazon.com, helped launch his national career as a solo performer. He's not originally a Seattle guy, but has been here, worked here, launched shows here. He's back now at Seattle Rep with two shows that he's going to be performing in alternating rep, American Utopias, and another that I can't say the name of on family radio, but it's about Ayn Rand and her influence on American culture. Mike Daisy, it's great to have you back in Seattle.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Well, so let's address the brouhaha about Steve Jobs, get it off the table, and then move on. Really, it seemed that the crux of this was about theater versus journalism. And I'm wondering if there was ever, did you ever consider yourself a journalist in presenting that show?
No, but I mean, the whole way journalism is constructed in our age, it has to do with narrative authority. And so, you know, every journalist is a storyteller, but they do it in the context where it creates a kind of a trust relationship with audiences, and we have framing devices like the reputation of National Public Radio, the ways in which we report the news, the way in which we tell stories on the news that connote and tell people that you can trust what you're hearing. And so I earnestly believe that all those forms are forms of storytelling, but they become very important social systems. And so I never thought of myself as a traditional journalist in any way. But because I'm really interested in stories about things that are happening around us, there tends to be a lot of blurring and overlap.
You told a Wall Street Journal writer, at least I read it on the Wall Street Journal blog, that I feel like my job is to try to create dramatic constructs that tell as truthful a story as they possibly can. You're also a dramatist. That is your profession. So how is telling the truth different when it comes to theater as opposed to on the pages of the Wall Street Journal or on the airwaves of This American Life?
Well, it's a difference in the ground assumptions, what people carry in with them. For instance, I performed Agony Ecstasy for a number of years. One of the things people don't understand is people would watch that monologue, which has always been about the labor conditions under which our devices are made. And those labor conditions are very well reported, especially today. It's very clear that they are truly dreadful. As people would come out of that monologue, and this would happen with great regularity, I would talk to people in the lobby and they say, is any of that true? Is there actually a company called Foxconn? Does Apple make anything in this way? Because the assumptions in the theater are actually the inverse of the assumptions in journalism. The assumption is that everything is a fiction. Every single thing, even the largest things, that everything is a cloud of fictions. It's one of the things I actually like about the theater, because I feel like that is actually closer to what real life is actually like. Hmm. And that it's very hard for us to tell when anything is true. You know, I think the assumptions are very different in these different worlds. And so what you're trying to do is you're trying to craft a story that, you know, tells a larger truth. And different people, different forms, and it's good that it does this, different forms do that in very different ways.
So essentially what you're talking about is sort of a universal truth as opposed to the sort of line of fact that a newspaper story or an NPR story is required to lay out. We hopefully, in radio stories, we strike a universal chord. But as a dramatist, what you're talking about is sort of an uber truth.
Yeah, I am. But at the same time, it occurs in every time anyone tells a story, every single narrative in the world involves an inherent subjectivity. For a great example, today is May 1st. It's May Day. Mm-hmm. So everyone gets a choice on how they talk about that day. A lot of the news reporting about that day today that I'm hearing on the radio begins with, today is May Day. Seattle police are out in force and they are watching for trouble. It doesn't lead with, today is May Day. Different organizations are organizing events, protesting different things. Here's what those things are. And there's a choice that's made about which one you lead with. And if you lead with the police, it suddenly sounds as though maybe there are terrorists out there. If you lead with the other one, you lead with the organizations, it sounds as though there's a civic event that you might actually want to participate in. And both are valid ways of talking about how things are, but they're very, very different.
So as a dramatist, somebody who's been working in crafting the kinds of stories that you tell for a long time, and you've gotten the Amazon show, 21 Dog Years, really kind of launched you to national light, but not in the same way that the Agony and Ecstasy of Steve Jobs did. Were you surprised by the sort of vitriol that got hurled your way?
No, I wasn't actually. I wasn't actually surprised by it.
No?
No, I really wasn't. I mean, I expected it to be really terrible when things fell apart, and it was. So I really wasn't that surprised.
So what did you do?
Well, you know, everyone's different, handles things differently. I've always been a maximalist, so I read everything.
Every attack on you?
I read every single article, every single blog post, and every single comment on the internet. Yeah, all of it.
And then what?
And then when I finished reading it, and it took a long time, and I had to keep taking breaks because it burned. But when I finished reading all of it, what happened is what happens with stories all the time. I was then larger than the story. And so it was one of the tools that helped me sort of assimilate the experience and begin to craft, you know, how I was going to go forward.
We're talking with Mike Daisy, who is back in Seattle with two shows that are not The Agony and Ecstasy of Steve Jobs. I had read somewhere where you said because the show was so wildly popular, and it was, you performed it all over the place, that other ideas you had were on back burners. And it wasn't just from dealing with the fallout from the This American Life broadcast, but just because people wanted you to come and perform Steve Jobs for them.
Oh, and more than that, actually, I have no problem disappointing people. I mean, I think that's clear. I have no problem disappointing people. I would just stop doing it. I actually did so much of it because there was what I wanted to do as an artist and what I felt I needed to do as a citizen. And that story, until 2012, you know, I was performing it in city after city. It was popular in those cities and setting a grassroots thing. But, you know, people didn't know what Foxconn was, had no idea about the fundamentals of what was going on in the supply systems for our electronics. So I felt compelled to do it in large amount.
The two shows in Seattle, we'll start with one I can't say the title of, which is about Ayn Rand, who is an author whose books I read as maybe a late teenager. It's kind of a darling of the American neocons and right wing. You want to talk a little bit more about why you would do a show about her and her writings?
Oh, the very fact that we would even, you know, have a question why, I mean, we should talk about Ayn Rand because she's literally the most important female figure in the literary mythos today. Like, Ayn Rand is like the beating heart of this conflict between the left and right. And she's this unaddressed force in the American political and literary landscape. We don't deal with Ayn Rand. We try our best to ignore the fact that those books exist.
Well, let's take a step back for folks who don't know who she is. The book I know the best is The Fountainhead, but describe her.
Oh, Ayn Rand is, you know, really the progenitor of a system of philosophy called objectivism, and really captured the idea of the virtue of selfishness. And a lot of her ideas, you know, in a current political discourse have wound their way into what was once called the Tea Party, and I would now argue is more like the mainstream of Republican ideology. So you're actually very familiar with her. And in fact, she's, you know, insanely popular and insanely well known. So, I mean, there are many people. In fact, there was a wonderful, a couple of years ago in Forbes, they did this survey, and 28% of Wall Street bankers, 28% of them, Ayn Rand is the only fiction they have ever read that was not assigned in a class. So, I mean, among certain groups, incredibly, incredibly powerful and popular.
You read it as a young kid.
I did.
And did you like it?
Well, I had a very charged relationship with it, which is one of the things I explore in the show, which is about that. And then it's also about sort of a pocket biography of Ayn Rand. I read it as an assignment from a very charismatic English teacher who was just a little bit cult-like. And so my relationship to the book is sort of inextricable from that experience of being with a bunch of other young people in a remote, rural, poor area, reading a book whose central tenets are that you, no matter how humble your origins, you can lift yourself up. And so the power of the book spoke to me, as it does for many people, because it's a very potent mimetic weapon.
Well, isn't that the American dream, that we, no matter who we are theoretically able to transcend our starting point to launch ourselves to wherever we imagine?
I think it's part of the dual-natured American dream. It has at least two natures, but I'd say that one strand is that we can all invent ourselves and reinvent ourselves, and we're perfectly free, no matter who we are, always to reinvent ourselves, which is a lie, but a very potent and exciting one. And then tied alongside it is the idea that that we're a Christian nation, and that we also will care for the least among us. This part of the mythology has become less popular over time.
All of which you explore, I'm assuming, in the show that we cannot name. It's sort of like He Who Will Not Be Named in
Harry
Potter.
I mean, it's called effing Ayn Rand.
Oh, thank you for the pronouncer.
Because by now they're all imagining something far worse than what we're discussing.
I'm just not allowed to say it on the air. But it seems that there's a tie. The other show I can tell the title of, it's called American Utopias. And it seems that the dream of objectivism is some sort of personal utopia. So American Utopias, you actually explore three real places, not three imagined dreams. But there is a tie between what we dream of as Americans, right?
I think so, yeah. It's three sort of voluntary dreamscapes that people enter into. And it's the landscape of Disney World, where I went for a week with my family, who's very, very serious about Disney World. They're big Disney fans, big ones, huge ones. It's about Burning Man and the week-long sort of celebration that happens out in the desert. And all the art that's created there and the sort of attempt to create a community that exists outside the strictures of our normal society. And it's about Occupy Wall Street and Zuccotti Park and sort of the birth of the Occupy movement and its intentions as it was originally formed as a community, and then what it wanted to be in respect to the rest of the society it was sort of attacking and interacting with.
Do people commission you with these particular subjects, or does everything that you make come out of a desire for you to explore that certain area?
Well, it's an interesting age. No one commissions me. I've gone to a lot of trouble to be an independent, unregulated artist. I answer to no one, and so I choose the topics that I'm obsessed with, and then I pursue them.
I was reading a profile of you where somebody said that all these subjects are somehow a facet of your own life, or at least you use them as lenses, or maybe you use your own life as a lens to look at these subjects. And there's this great quote, Spalding Gray said, there's a relationship between extemporaneous performance and therapy. You told an interviewer, I think that's true.
Yeah.
How so?
Well, I mean, we call the therapy the talking cure, right? We talk about it as the way of like talking through a problem. So, and inherent to most therapy is the sort of the Greek concept of catharsis, which, depending on your lensing of catharsis, how you describe it, is the moment of self-realization. Like in all the great Greek tragedies, the moment of highest culmination is when the hero realizes, even when he realizes something really terrible, and then they have to dig out their eyes, which is terrible for all of us. But even if that's what happens, it's the moment of self-realization. So in a large part, you know, the creative act is therapeutic in the sense that you are exploring something that you feel passionately about, and in the process of exploring it live with an audience, you are discovering what you think of it. And as we unearth those things about ourselves, if you're making good decisions about what you're building and looking for in your life, generally, as you learn about yourself, it's good.
But it's interesting because therapy, in its strictest sense, talk therapy, we're doing in private with somebody who has some professional regulations in which they can't divulge those cathartic moments that we reveal. A lot of playwrights, if we're going to focus on theater, especially those Greek tragedians, we may adapt their work, but that work they made, it's done. It's performed in a sort of similar way. Your work, while there is a framework for it, changes every time you perform it, I think, right?
Yeah.
And so you're constantly going through some new exploration, even though I know there are guidelines. So what I'm wondering is that you could be on the stage at the Seattle Rep tonight or tomorrow or the next night, and you could be learning something new each of those nights, right?
Yes, yes, all the time.
And revealing something new to each of us.
Yes.
Each audience.
And to me, it's very likely.
That seems incredibly energy intensive.
It is. It's very energy intensive. In fact, requires almost all my energy.
So when you go back to the first couple of shows that you did, nobody's, except for some Seattle audiences who might have seen them, they won't know, but people will think maybe 21 Dog Years, which I don't think that you've revisited in a while. But maybe,
oh, no, it's been years.
So I guess what I'm wondering is, as you progress and you learn these new things and you look back at Dog Years, which springs from your time at Amazon.com, or you look back at the more recent brouhaha for Steve Jobs, do these seem like ancient past, that you're a different person because you're experiencing this kind of therapeutic artistic moment every time you're on stage?
Oh, I'm sure it's like it is for other people. I think we all have that dual nature where we feel like, oh, that was another person. I was so young then. And we remember it as at a distance. At the same time, I think that like most people, it's very clear to me that it's the same person. You know, I feel the through line of my own life like alongside. So, no, it's like both simultaneously, like depending on your day and depending on where you're standing, you feel both very close to it and very far away from it.
And so you're going to be performing on alternating nights, effing Ayn Rand and American Utopias?
It's actually this week is American Utopias okay. And next week is Ayn Rand. But so I do often alternate shows.
That seems like that would be not even energy intensive, but you might be having some sort of, you know, psychic dissonance by ping-ponging between these shows because they require so much of you.
I think that also time and experience helps. You know, I'm working on a show for this fall, which is called All the Faces of the Moon, which will be performed over a lunar month. So it's 29 monologues. It's a 29 chapter show.
A different one every night?
Correct. Each night is a different chapter in a really large story that will all be streamed online and available to everyone so that everyone, if they choose to, can participate in it. And so I think the scale of the kind of stories that I want to tell is getting larger and shifting. And so over time, you know, when I started, I probably could not have imagined where I am now, but that's true of lots of things in life.
So of the things that you have, you know, just to go back to the agony and ecstasy of Steve Jobs, how will you approach the month of 29 stories differently than you might have before Steve Jobs?
Well, in some ways, not very differently at all. You know, I think that I'm wiser now about the boundaries that people have and feel between things, and more importantly, the authority that we choose to take. You know, the truth is that, you know, in the year that's passed since everything, I feel very strongly more than ever that, you know, all stories are fiction, which makes it really important that if you're going to take the authority to tell a story, the way in which you want it to be true, if it's going to be in journalism, in media, and then those are the ground rules that exist for those forms, you have to be very careful about where you're going to allow your story to be taken. And so, you know, I'm not planning right now to have my 29-part monologue, you know, airing on the NBC Nightly News. So as a consequence, you know, it's not going to change very much. And different things require different stories, have different valences and different requirements for what they want from us.
Mike Daisey's going to be performing his two monologues, American Utopias, this week and Effing Ayn Rand next week at Seattle Repertory Theater through the 11th. Thank you for coming in today.
Thanks for having me.
And we're going to go out with a clip from American Utopias, and you're at Burning Man surveying the landscape.
It's tense as far as the eye can see, and now the dust is blowing in every direction, and it looks, for all the world, like Mogadishu during a rave. There's a green laser sort of blinking up into the dust on one side and a giant purple light pulsing. And I get into the tent and all the visuals now vanish and there's just the sound, the omnipresent soundscape that accompanies everything at Burning Man. The sound of oots, 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 as though an army of Eurotrash DJs has been parachuted into this place. They're all coming in the sky. Oots, 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 oots. They're landing in every location. Oots, oots, oots. You can't point source where it's coming from. In fact, when you get in a tent, you can feel it coming through the earth itself from below you. Oots, 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 oots. Like God is down deep in the earth laying down some fat beats. Oots, 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 oots.
Performance artist Mike Daisey. That's from his current stage show, American Utopias. I'm Bernard Ouellette. It's 9:38. Did you know that the carrot is related to dill, parsley, and cumin, and that's why their flavors go together so well? What else don't you know about your veggies? We'll find out in a minute.
Support for KUOW comes from Nissan and the 100% electric Nissan Leaf, whose drivers have driven more than 150 million miles gas-free. More at NissanUSA.com.
It is sunny in Seattle, 49 degrees, expecting to reach 64 this afternoon. Then it's clear sky overnight with a low of 43, more sun tomorrow, Thursday, with a high of 70,
and then sun and daytime temperatures up into the 70s all the way through the beginning of next week.
Support for KUOW comes from the UW Medicine Regional Heart Center, where patients from the Puget Sound area and throughout the Pacific Northwest region receive multidisciplinary comprehensive cardiovascular care. More information at uwmedicine.org.
What's going on in Canada? Well, four folks who want to be British Columbia's next premier met in their first TV debate earlier this week. There was a lot of talk about jobs and the economy. What happened at that debate and what does it mean for the candidates going forward? Vancouver Sun journalist Vaughn Palmer joins us in 25 minutes.
From 94.9 KUOW Seattle, I'm Marcy Silman. If you're a home cook, you probably have a go-to book you consult. For my mother's generation, that book was The Joy of Cooking. I actually still have a copy of her old paperback on my kitchen bookshelf, and I use it for cornmeal pancakes, and I think that's about it. When I have a culinary question, I brought in a very, very tattered copy of Deborah Madison's Vegetarian Cooking for Everyone. You can look up a vegetable in it and then figure out what to do with that vegetable, like escarole. I learned how to braise escarole last summer. This is one of my Bibles, and maybe it'll be supplanted because Deborah Madison has a new book that could accompany it, if not replace it. It's called Vegetable Literacy, and Deborah Madison, it's very wonderful to meet you. I cook from this book all the time. So.
Well, thank you. It's wonderful to be here.
Vegetable literacy, though, isn't a cookbook in the same way that your other books have.
No, it's not. It has a lot of recipes. It has 300 recipes, but it's really more about plant families. And the recipes illustrate the use of members of those families, most of which are fairly familiar to us.
You write in the beginning of this book that this kind of started because you have been gardening.
Mm-hmm. That's true.
And so what were you looking at plants one day and thinking, gosh, this one has a leaf that looks like a heart, and so does that one.
Yeah, only it was a flower.
Oh, really?
It really literally started like that with carrots that I'd let go for a year, and they bloomed the next year. I thought, oh, they're so beautiful, these umbels. And then I started noticing similarities with other plants that I grew, like parsley and fennel and chervil and cilantro. And, oh, it's interesting. They're all making the same flowers. And then I went to my botany books.
Had you been a botany student before this?
No, not at all. Now, my father was a botanist. My brother is a botanist. I mean, I grew up with a father who, when we took walks, was always mumbling in Latin, you know, about this and that plant. But it didn't rub off on me in a very conscious way. I didn't even plant my first plant until I was 35.
So, 35?
Yeah.
Even though you were cooking for years before that?
I lived in a community. I didn't really have a place where I could do it. Perhaps had that not been the case, I might have been motivated to plant something. But no, it didn't really occur to me until I had this blank, ugly piece of clay earth in front of me to look at all day. And I thought, this needs a plant. Or 500 plants or whatever.
And were you thinking specifically edible plants at that point?
No, because I lived on a farm. And so there were all these edible plants being grown. Why grow more of them? I was eating with community anyway. So I was interested more in flowers. And
so you planted pretty things.
Lots of flowers, yeah.
So this garden that you have now is to a great extent a culinary garden.
It is, yeah. I got very interested in it. I thought I should. First of all, I was on the board of Seed Savers Exchange for about 6 years,
which is an organization that's preserving sort of heritage heirloom varieties of vegetables.
It's really the one that started that whole movement. And going to board meetings in Iowa, where it's located, I mean, I was privileged to see these absolutely beautiful gardens planted out in the plants that are in the seeds that are in the catalog, these old heirlooms. And I felt like I ought to be able to do this if I'm on the board. I really need to give it a try.
Sort of like honor, you had to be held to a certain standard.
I did feel that.
We're talking with Deborah Madison, and many of you who are cooks may know her from her number of cookbooks or writing restaurants that you don't have a restaurant, as far as I know, anymore. But this new book, Vegetable Literacy, takes 12 plant families. Some of them are kind of herb families. And what you do is write about how these plants are alike and And then the cooking part of it is how we can maybe use them interchangeably.
Well, yes, I think families, you know, have members who are relatives just like humans do, and they share characteristics very often. So if you know that beets and spinach and chard and a number of other plants in that family are related, you can feel a little more relaxed in the kitchen about making substitutes.
Were you relaxed anyways, though? I get the impression that you were growing these things and saying, well, hey, I'm just, wonder what this tastes like. Let me eat it. Let me cook it.
Yeah, there's certainly a bit of that.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So back to Iowa and Seed Savers, a lot of the plants that people who are interested in preserving heirloom varieties try to save are only available if you get hold of these seeds. I mean, so many plants have disappeared from usage in the United States. I'm not sure about overseas. That when I read this book and I look through some of these plants, I'm like, I don't know, you know, purslane, if that's mm-hmm. how you pronounce it. I'm not sure I've ever even seen it. You know,
well, if you have a garden, you probably have, because it creeps along the path.
It's a weed?
And it's a weed.
Weedy
and
plant.
It's, I mean, it arrives without your doing anything, although there's some wonderful cultivars of purslane that are better than the weedy kind, I think. But that's one of those plants that's really found around the world, pretty much.
There are others as well. But,
yeah.
I mean, how do you know when they're okay to eat, and particularly things like the green seeds of the coriander plant, which you talk about that you make them. I'm sure I have never seen those, but why would you think to eat those?
Well, because I know that cilantro is something I eat when those little green buds, you know, dry and turn to coriander. That's something else we eat. So I just had them and I figured they're probably good to eat, too. It's from an edible plant. And it's not like you're eating tons and tons of them. I mean, I just noticed coriander goes to seed really fast, and or cilantro goes to seed really fast. But before it makes coriander, it makes these little green bulbs. And I thought, I believe they would be edible.
So they are. If, for example, I don't have a big garden, but I grow greens, and I've got... your book inspired me to do this, and I haven't dropped dead, so it's probably okay. I grew kale, Tuscan kale, and then it bolted, has yellow flowers, mm-hmm. and so I picked some and ate them.
Good.
Yeah, they were sweet, actually.
They are sweet.
But then I thought, well, can I do that with any edible plant, or are some things toxic in some, like our roots, or are there things that I need to watch out
well,
for?
Well, I mean, this book does not venture off into great unknowns. You know,
I'm not going to kill myself.
It's rather safe in a way. It's so when something is in fact toxic, you know, like rhubarb leaves or potato greens, or you know, I say that. I don't know that people would be tempted to eat them because they don't taste very good. But other things are edible. If you're charred bolts, those leaves get smaller and further apart, and they don't look like chard in the store. But they're quite edible. It's the same plant. It's just later in its, you know, in its development.
We're talking with Deborah Madison, and one thing... I mean, this book that I had you sign it, and I brought it in just so you could see that I really do cook out of it. Vegetarian Cooking for Everyone is essentially, there's a lot of, I don't know how many recipes are in there, but you take vegetables and you tell, like I look up escarole, for example, and I learned how to braise it. I can look up Jerusalem artichoke. I can look up asparagus, and you tell me what goes well with it. I was shocked to read that you are not a vegetarian.
Well, I'm not. I was for about 20 years. But when I first started writing, I realized, I sensed anyway, that the main question I would get asked if I was a vegetarian was, do you get enough protein? And I did not want to spend my life on that question. I'm really concerned about our whole food system and making it better. That includes animals as well as plants. And I wanted to be able to work more freely in that way. And also, I like an open door, open table kind of policy, feeling that everybody can come to the table. And I always found vegetarian is a little pushing pushing things away. So I just didn't want to get involved with that. I'm probably about 90% vegetarian.
You have been involved with food professionally for, I think, about 40 years.
Isn't that long?
Yeah, I'm sorry. But if I'm doing my math right, since the 70s.
I know that's true because young people come up to me and say, I was raised on the Greens Cookbook. Now they are raised on vegetarian cooking for everyone, which is a shock.
I'm wondering how American attitudes, as you've seen, have changed towards food over that time?
Well, I think with regards to the plant world, you know, I think we're suddenly getting more open to it. And so many people who have used vegetarian cooking for everyone, even to the extent that you've used your book, will come up to me and say, I'm not a vegetarian, but... And which is great. It's vegetarian cooking for everyone. It's vegetable cooking for everyone. So I feel like there's a lot more openness now, and one doesn't have to identify a lifestyle with how one eats. You know, it used to be if you were a vegetarian, you had to really defend it, you know, and be insistent and be a problem for other people and so forth. Now it's much easier.
It seems interesting, though, that at a time when more people are at least listening to folks like Michael Pollan talk about, you know, eat real food.
Eat plants.
Eat plants and, you know, sort of shop the perimeter of the grocery store and don't buy things that have names that your grandparents wouldn't recognize. I think I'm summing up the rules from his writing, that so many of our plant varieties are disappearing, to go back to the idea of seed savers, that we have, oddly, less commercial option when it comes to types of vegetables.
Oh, I actually see it a little differently.
Really?
I think that partly because of seed savers, there's been such a renewed interest in varieties, and particularly heritage varieties of vegetables and fruits and so forth, that in my experience, there's much, much more in terms of variety. There are different kinds of variety, though. In the supermarket, the variety you see, I think of it as horizontal. You have a lot of different foods from around the world, but you don't have a lot of varieties of any one of them. The farmers market, you start to see it's different because farmers markets are based on local food, so they can't have food from climates from around the world. But if someone's growing kale, they might have five or six different kinds of kale. They might have harvested those stalks and blossoms that you talked about, which I just saw in the Portland farmers market.
Really?
Oh, yeah. Of every brassica, they were selling collard sprouts, you know, the tops, and broccoli and kale and so forth, and discovering that, in fact, this is edible. You can eat the whole plant.
Well, that is new for me, and I only tasted these things on the advice of somebody who said I wasn't going to poison myself by doing that. I wouldn't do that maybe with mushrooms.
Mushrooms are another thing, and they're fungi anyway.
And they're not in this book.
Right.
I mean, this is just, I mean, we're talking about 12 plant families. There are many more than that, and you had to cut the...
Yeah, I couldn't go on forever. I mean, you know, one has limits.
So when you're out there, I'm assuming that you grow more than what you've written about in this book. When you're out looking through your garden or at the farmer's market, do you see everything with its potential for how you would cook it? Or, I mean, how do you view these vegetables?
Well, one of the ways of viewing vegetables and their potential that I think where a garden really makes a difference is that you see the whole plant. And at the supermarket and even at the farmer's market, we don't. We see parts and pieces. It's like a butcher counter. I mean, we see the crown of the broccoli. We see the head of the cauliflower. We don't see the leaves. There's lots of things we don't see. And so we don't know what's possible or why and how plants got their names, because we're just seeing something that's very abbreviated. In the garden, you have a chance to see that a wintered over leek is maybe 4 feet tall and has enormous greens on it that you can wave like a flag. And some of the names for leeks and catalogs are, one is American flag.
Wow.
And suddenly it makes sense, you know, that you see things are connected, that it's not just random. A lot of things, I think, and it's like paint chips. You know, the names are sort of random of newly developed hybridized vegetables. But when you look at what's been there for a while, you see that it really reflects the nature of the plant. And that's kind of exciting.
I know that you started off, I think you started off your culinary career cooking at the Zen Center in Marin County across from San Francisco. Am I right about
well,
that?
Well, yes, in San Francisco, actually. And we had a farm and still do in Muir Beach.
So that idea of sort of being present in the moment, of how does that tie in with cooking or with gardening or with what you're writing about in vegetable
well,
literacy?
I mean, with cooking, I think it's if you're not present in the moment, there are definitely consequences. You know, I mean,
things catch on fire.
Things get burned. You catch towels on fire. You burn yourself or whatever. So, you know, cooking is a great way to develop that because it really demands that you pay attention, which isn't necessarily a mental watching, but your ear. You know, you can hear when something changes in the pan and you know it's time to add the liquid or do this or that. It's kind of wonderfully physical and intuitive after a while.
Do you still have that same satisfaction so many years later when you're in the kitchen?
I do. It always feels good to go from writing, which is so mental, to doing something with my hands, whether it's gardening or cooking. It's a good balance.
So for those of us who maybe live in apartments or live in places where we can't grow things, how can we take what you've written about in vegetable literacy and incorporate it into our own little tiny kitchens?
Well, I think that there are many ways to have a garden. You don't have to own the garden. I know that many farmers markets have farm tours where you can go and tour a farm. You're going to see things growing. You're going to see them in their whole forms, or botanical gardens, or maybe a neighbor or friend has a garden. So I think if you get inspired by this in any way, you'll find that there are lots of opportunities.
And then, of course, you get to take the stuff home and cook it and eat it.
There you go.
I mean, I do confess, eating one of the greatest joys of life. Deborah Madison is a food writer, a gardener, a chef, and you know, now sort of a taxonomist, lay botanist.
Even that's overreaching, I think. I'm teaching myself.
Her new book, which is does include 300 recipes, but is more than a cookbook, is called Vegetable Literacy. It's been a great delight to have you here.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. From 94.9 KUOW, I'm Marcy Silman.
And now, the sound of the day.
Sounds like from a creature from the deep. Our listener, Phil, recorded this sound while doing maintenance on the seawater intake system for the Port Townsend Marine Science Center. Wow, it's almost musical. It's the water gently sloshing in one of the intake lines. I wonder where Phil had his microphone. That's kind of cool. It just sounds like a... Bernard, isn't that neat?
Yeah, that is. I like it.
Sounds like music, doesn't
it? It's almost
it?
Like a percussion from John Cage or something.
It is. Very, very cool. I'm not sure if you can top this, listeners, but we're curious about what interesting sounds you're listening to. We'd love for you to record 30 seconds of the sound, send it along to us, along with the story behind the sound. Email it to weekday@kuow.org, and be sure to include sound of the day in the subject line. Stay with us. Coming up in the next hour, Vaughn Palmer talks about all the stuff that's happening in Canada, including the very low-priced Canadian gift giving to the President of the United States. They gave him a basketball, Bernard.
Mm. Well, he does like to shoot some hoops.
It's in a glass cage.
It's the thought that counts.
It is the thought that counts. Robert Horton talks about cinema without sound, and Todd Bishop's going to be in here to talk about why Amazon.com is expanding Amazon Fresh, whether that's a good thing or not. It's all coming up, Bernard.
All right, cool. We'll stick around for that. It's 9:59. Today is day one for civil unions in Colorado. That's in the news in a minute. KUOW FM Seattle, KUOW Tumwater, KQOW Bellingham, and Digital HD Services.
Support for KUOW comes from Half Price Books, buying and selling new and used books, music, movies, and more. A wide selection of hardbacks, paperbacks, DVDs, LPs, and CDs at every location. More information and store locations at hpb.com.
Explain aloud just what you're doing.
Radioactive is a journalism training program for youth ages 16 to 18.
We have some pretty great stories for you.
Summer applications are now open.
So tune in
if you dare.
Apply online by May 13th at kuow.org/radioactive.
. 50 degrees in Seattle. It's going to be a day of sunshine, blue sky, and mountain views with a high of 64. Forecast for the next 6 days, sun, 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 and sun.
Support for KUOW comes from UW College of Education, presenting the National Center for Quality Teaching and Learning Distinguished Lecture Series on topics related to early learning of science and math. Details about...
Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at KUOW.org.